It's Bigler's World. Bop-a-doo for the next hour. And that's going to make me Jim Bigler. For most of that hour, at least. What do we got here? A bunch of kids' magazines. Got some National Geographic kids. I don't think I'll do Ranger Rick. Maybe I will. Maybe I'll break down and do some Ranger Rick. A little science news for kids. Let's start with Dogo news for kids. This article entitled, China's Latest Must-Have Pet, Dolan Sheep, spelled D-O-L-A-N. Mira Dolazia wrote this particular article, and it starts out like this. A sheep is a sheep is a sheep, right? Apparently not. If you happen to be part of the rare Dolan breed, with only 1,000 of them known to exist in the world, they have become a coveted pet amongst China's wealthiest, who are ready to pay hefty sums to get their hands on one. In case you're wondering, the sheep are not covered in gold fur. They are simply unique-looking creatures with regal curved noses, long floppy ears, and twin tails. The animals, which are bred in Kashi, China, were once very popular for food because they are large and they mature quickly. However, over the years, they were slowly replaced by normal sheep, leaving very few of them around. But this recent craze may change things. That's because sheep breeders in Kashi are now selling their entire herds to purchase one breeding Dolan sheep. Those who cannot afford to buy them individually are pooling their money and forming consortiums. Yes, sheep consortiums. So far, they have not been disappointed. One breeder who made the switch and bought two Dolan sheep for 25,000 yen, that is $3,900 US, back in 2009, said she recently got an offer to sell them for 10 times his original investment. As happens in the section of selection of any pet, there it is, the price depends on how good the animal looks. Dolan sheep with darker fleece, big floppy ears, and nicely curved faces are worth a lot more than ordinary lookers. While all of them seem to sell for ridiculous prices, the most coveted one is a 6-year-old Dolan owned by Kashi resident Majid Abdul Rayem. The breeder claims that he has received over 14 offers, some exceeding 14 million yuan, that's about $2.2 million. For this distinguished animal, but has not succumbed to any yet. Mr. Rayam, who feeds his 19 Dolans a special diet of grass, dates, and walnuts, believes that the 6-year-old is a high pedigree specimen, one that is capable of producing really distinguished offspring, therefore too precious to sell. This is not the first animal that wealthy Chinese have taken a fancy to. Back in 2009, a rich couple broke the world record for owning the most expensive dog after paying $500,000 for a really purebred Tibetan Mastiff dubbed Yangtze River No. 2. They already owned No. 1. And then it says, pretty amazing. Okay, let's go to another publication. We got newsforkids.net right here on Bigler's World. This article entitled, U.S. Solar and Wind, More Power Than Coal in 2024. Last year, the U.S. got more of its electricity from wind and solar power than from coal. It's the first time that's ever happened, and it shows how quickly the U.S. is moving toward cleaner energy sources. Because renewable energy is so cheap, it will probably continue to grow, despite President Donald Trump's push to increase fossil fuel use. The U.S. gets its electricity from many different sources. In 2024, around 58% of the country's electricity came from fossil fuels like natural gas, oil, and coal. But Ember, a company that studies energy use, says renewable energy is growing rapidly. In 2024, wind and solar power provided 17% of the electricity in the U.S. For the first time ever, these renewables beat coal, which provided just 15% of U.S.'s electricity. That's a huge change. Ember says that in 2018, just 6 years ago, coal produced 3 times as much electricity as wind and solar power combined. Wind and solar energy are growing because they've gotten cheaper and cheaper. That's especially true for solar power, which produced 81% of the extra electricity added to the grid last year. Though solar is growing much faster, wind energy is still bigger than solar, providing about 10% of the country's electricity. Under ex-President Joe Biden, the U.S. government worked hard to promote renewable energy. That changed when Mr. Trump took office in January. Mr. Trump is pushing hard to promote polluting fossil fuels. Even so, experts say renewable energy will probably continue to grow. The main reason is that renewable energy sources are cheaper. The U.S. added 50 gigawatts of solar power in a single year last year. That's enough to supply the electricity required by more than 37 million average U.S. homes. And solar energy is expected to grow even more in the future. Natural gas is still a major source of energy in the U.S. It produced about 42.5% of the country's electricity last year. Natural gas is cleaner than coal, but it is still a fossil fuel, and that makes the climate crisis worse. Fuels like natural gas have one big advantage. They can supply power even at night. Solar electricity is only produced when the sun is shining, but Ember's report suggests that as more large-scale battery stations are added to the grid, solar power will be available around the clock, too. For years, the demand for electricity in the U.S. has remained about the same, but now demand is rising, and it's expected to keep going up. There are several reasons, including more large computer centers providing artificial intelligence or AI services, cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, and an increase in the number of electric cars. To reduce pollution and fight climate change, the U.S. will need to continue to grow its renewable energy sources. Another report released last week says that by 2040, the country will need 900 more gigawatts of renewable energy and battery storage. Dave Jones, who led the study for Ember, believes that with battery storage, solar will grow faster and remain cheaper than natural gas. He says, solar is winning. At the bottom of the article, it says, did you know? Did you know? The pattern is similar in other countries. Last year in the European Union, or the EU, solar power produced more electricity than coal for the first time ever, and solar and wind together produced more than coal and natural gas combined. Last year was also the first time that renewable energy sources in the United Kingdom produced more electricity than fossil fuels. Okay, let's do one more article in News for Kids right here on Bigler's World. Bigler's World. Let's see, this article entitled, Scientists Use AI to Track Down Endangered Bird. Melbourne, Australia. Scientists in Australia have used artificial intelligence, or AI, to help them locate a rare bird called the Plains Wanderer. This new information will help scientists protect the birds, which are endangered. The Plains Wanderer is a small bird that lives in Australia's grasslands. Not just any grasslands, no. Plains wanderers are picky. There can't be too much grass or too little. For this reason, scientists sometimes call them the Goldilocks of animals. The birds were once common in eastern Australia, but that changed as grasslands have been turned into farms and cities. Zoos Victoria, the group behind the recent effort to locate plains wanderers, says the birds' numbers have fallen by over 85% in recent decades. The scientists believe that there are now only 250 to 1,000 of the birds left in the wild. The odd little birds are only about 6 inches tall. They're not good at flying, so they spend most of their time on the ground. When they feel threatened, they crouch down to hide. Normally, they choose to run away rather than fly. Zoos Victoria says, there is no bird like it in the world. In fact, scientists have put the species into a family all by itself since there are no other similar birds. One thing that makes plains wanderers unusual is that the females are larger and are in charge of protecting the territory. The male birds are smaller and they take care of the eggs. Plains wanderers are generally brown and white, with yellow legs and beaks. The females are more colorful, with a band of black and white below their necks and a red spot on their chests. To protect these rare birds, the scientists first had to learn where they were, so Zoos Victoria worked with Queensland University of Technology to plan to locate the birds. Since plains wanderers are hard to spot, the team chose to listen for the birds instead. Female plains wanderers make an unusual call, and this was the key to locating them. The researchers set up 35 special recording devices called song meters in 9 different grassy areas where plains wanderers could possibly have been. Song meters record all the sounds made in an area over a long period of time. The song meters collected tens of thousands of hours of recordings, far more than humans could analyze, so the researchers fed the recordings to an AI system trained to identify the calls of plains wanderers. The AI system discovered plains wanderers' calls coming from 2 of the sites. The scientists double-checked and found that the AI system was correct. Chris Harnett, who works with Zoos Victoria, said it was like finding gold. It's the first time in over 30 years that the plains wanderer has been found west of Melbourne. Or is it Melbourne? I think it's Bourne. Mr. Harnett says the discovery is huge. The new information will help scientists protect the birds. The team planned to work with the landowners to help protect the birds and the grasslands they depend on. And the researchers are still listening, using song meters and AI to try to locate more of these Goldilocks birds. And on the bottom it says, did you know Zoos Australia isn't just protecting plains wanderers in the wild, they are also raising more of the endangered birds in captivity and releasing them into the wild. Okay, let's go over to Science News Explores. This article, scientists say dark lightning. They explain dark lightning. I didn't know that thing existed. This invisible cousin of regular lightning may not light the skies, but it sure packs an energetic punch, says Katie Grace Carpenter, who wrote this. Dark lightning refers to bursts of gamma radiation that can occur during thunderstorms. Gamma radiation, made up of gamma rays, is a kind of light. Gamma rays pack the most energy of all radiation that occurs naturally on Earth. And dark lightning is a natural source of gamma radiation. That's why some experts call dark lightning by another name, terrestrial gamma ray flashes. We cannot see dark lightning. That's because we cannot see gamma rays. Our eyes can only detect light within a specific wavelength range. Light within that range is what we call visible light. Any light outside that range is invisible to us. Oh, I see where they're going with this. Gamma rays have a much shorter wavelength than the light in our visible range. Scientists think the same processes that create regular visible lightning also create dark lightning. But some details of that process remain a mystery. Lightning occurs when opposing electrical charges build up at the top and bottom of a storm cloud. Often a negative charge builds up at the bottom of the cloud and the top remains more positive. These electrical fields of energized electrons, these electrical fields energize electrons, that's what it is. Sometimes this difference discharges as a bolt of electricity. We see that as regular lightning. Experts think dark lightning arises in much the same way. Energized particles can crash into atoms in our atmosphere. Collisions between atoms and the high-velocity particles releases a lot of energy, and these collisions can emit gamma rays. Scientists suspect this may contribute to bursts of dark lightning. However, it must require just the right conditions because dark lightning is rarer than regular lightning. Experts estimate about 1,000 bursts of regular lightning occur for every 1 bolt of dark lightning. Next article. Sticking with Science News Explorers. This is titled, DeepSeek Pioneers, a New Way for AI to Reason. And it uses far less energy than ChatGPT and similar bots, says Catherine Hulick, who wrote this article. Have you tried out DeepSeek? Released on January 20th, this new artificial intelligence tool quickly became the world's most downloaded free app. It held that spot for several days. More than 22 million people were using it to chat, assist with writing and coding, and more. Such bots are tools built on top of a type of AI known as large language model. New AI bots pop up all the time. Some of the best known, ChatGPT, Grok, Claude, and Gemini, can all perform similar tasks. So what made DeepSeek special? Well, it matches the performance of the best of those, but it needs less energy to do so, explains Vijay Gadapalli. Makes it better for the environment per unit of work, he explains. Gadapalli is a computer scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Lincoln Laboratory in Lexington. There he works on boosting the efficiency of AI models and the computers that run them. He did not take part in DeepSeek's development, however. AI models have a reputation for being energy hogs. But the team that made the DeepSeek bot found clever innovations to slim down the processes of both developing and running AI models, says Gadapalli. This was very novel, he says. The team was part of a company based in Hangzhou, China. It announced the energy-saving approach last December 27th on AirXIV. A month later, this company, which is also confusingly named DeepSeek, released a new bot. It had been built on top of a slimmer AI model. People call this new bot DeepSeek. Its technical name, however, is DeepSeek R1. It can answer questions like an ordinary chat bot, but it's actually something new. This new type of bot is known as a reasoning agent. Less chat and more action. A chat bot answers one question at a time. A reasoning agent doesn't. It can, explains Gadapalli, take a complex task and break it into smaller pieces. Your initial question or request goes into the underlying AI model, which comes up with an answer. But the agent doesn't stop there. It uses the first answer to ask itself more questions. This process is somewhat similar to what people do when they think over a task. Researchers call this a chain of thought. Depending on the difficulty of the task, this process can take a few seconds or as much as a half hour. During this time, questions and answers are bouncing around inside the model, says Gadapalli. Reasoning agents are most useful when paired with search engines, robots, and other technology. When this happens, questions and answers bounce in and out of the model, too. The reasoning agent acts sort of like a brain to direct other tools. This entire system can then act on your behalf and actually perform some activity, Gadapalli explains. OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT, has also developed AI models that support this sort of system. The first one was called O1. Is that O1? I don't know if that's a zero or not. This model, or newer versions of it, support several agents. One agent is called Operator. It has access to a web browser so it can do things such as book appointments for you. Another agent called Deep Research uses search engines. It can gather information and create a custom report. The newsletter Understanding AI had 19 people try out Deep Research. Seven of them said the tool accomplished work similar to what a professional in their field could do. But OpenAI charges $200 per month for a subscription to this agent. And to use O1 directly, you must pay $60 for every million words of output. When the DeepSeek R1 agent came out, it could do the same sorts of tasks as agents built on top of O1. But DeepSeek's model is far more efficient. It costs just $2.19 for every million words. This shocked many experts. Who is this? Jeremy Harris on his podcast. He says, I can get a lot more intelligence for the same amount of computing power. That's Jeremy Harris on his podcast last week in AI. That is the DeepSeek story. It's absolutely impressive, he adds. This is legit. In addition to co-hosting this podcast, Harris runs Gladstone AI, a company based in Washington, D.C. Another benefit to DeepSeek, its maker has shared how it built the reasoning agent and the model that runs it. Techies call this open source tech. ChatGPT's developer, OpenAI, has taken a different approach. It's kept technical details of its bot and platform secret. Who is this? Avijit Ghosh, based in Boston, Massachusetts, says, open source tools give you the benefit of peeking under the hood and seeing what's going on. Avijit Ghosh is an expert in AI ethics at the company Hugging Face. This company runs a platform for open source AI development. Anyone can now build their own version of DeepSeek. Some have already done so. The AI company Perplexity launched a free deep research tool in February. It's built using a modified version of DeepSeek R1. The future of thinking AI. AI companies often describe their reasoning agents as thinking machines. That can be misleading. These agents do perform impressive feats, but they don't work like our brains do. They are built on the same sorts of AI models as chatbots. That means that they can suffer some of the same drawbacks. They may produce biased content, for instance, or people can jailbreak them to get around safety guardrails, and those bots may sometimes confidently provide wrong information, a problem called hallucinating. When an agent uses a model to perform a complex task on its own, a bunch of small problems can also snowball into bigger ones, notes Ghosh, and that worries him. He co-authored a paper on AIR XIV in February that sums it up. Fully autonomous AI agents should not be developed. Being fully autonomous, explains Ghosh, means being able to act entirely on its own. Science News Explorers reached out to DeepSeek for comment, but the company didn't respond. DeepSeek R1 and similar bots aren't fully autonomous yet. They can do more complex tasks than chatbot. Yet a real person still guides the process. And Ghosh thinks that that is essential. He says, I don't think these systems are nearly as reliable as and accountable as humans, he says. But things are moving quickly. In late February, the robot company Figure AI announced a new AI model called Helix. Robots that use this model are better at reasoning. In early March, a different Chinese company named Monica announced a brand new agent called Manus. It's built atop a handful of different AI models. It's also close to fully autonomous. When you give it a task, it decides on its own how it should solve it. Then it starts taking actions, such as searching online, writing code, creating charts, and more. This all happens in the cloud while you wait. Manus then alerts you when its task is done. And consider this. Companies like DeepSeek, Monica, and OpenAI can now use their agents to come up with ideas on how to build better reasoning models. Harris of Last Week in AI is confident that this is already happening. How well they work remains to be seen. Clearly, it's an exciting time for AI innovation. Okay, let's do one more article from Science News Explorers before moving on to other stuff. This is an article called Wiggling Robots Reveal the Physics of How Hula Hoops Stay Up. Okay. The researchers provide tips for people who want to learn how to use the toys. Okay. Emily Conover wrote this here. Spinning hoop slinging robots are revealing the physics of a favorite toy, the hula hoop. Scientists found that those robots had to have a particular shape in order to hula hoop, and that helped explain how the hoops stay up against gravity. The robots were designed to move in small circles, similar to a person hula hooping, but only some bots could keep the hoop up. Those robots had indented middles like an hourglass. The slope at the bottom of the indent provides an upward force to the hoop as it swings around. And that's what helps counter gravity. And the curvature of that shape kept the spinning ring from drifting up or down and sliding off. Who is this? Leif Ristroff. He is an applied mathematician in New York City at New York University. Inspired by performers near his home in Greenwich Village, he began considering the physics of hula hoops. He was part of a team that realized earlier work hadn't truly explained how the hoops stay up. Ristroff has a track record of tackling quirky science questions. His group recently investigated what would happen if a lawn sprinkler sucked water in instead of shooting it out. You'd have a dead lawn, I guess. So Ristroff and his colleagues gave the science of toy hoops a whirl. They ran experiments with a series of gyrating robots. Gyrating, by the way, means to move around in fast, tight circles. A robot shaped like a cylinder couldn't keep its rotating hoop from sliding down. Another robot was shaped like an upside-down ice cream cone. Its slope helped counteract gravity's downward pull on the hoop, but it had no curvy indent. It, too, couldn't keep its hoop up. If the hoop began towards the top of the cone, it would migrate up, then it would be flung away. If the hoop started near the bottom, it would migrate down to the ground. Only a robot indented in the middle could keep a hoop steadily aloft. This showed how hoops stay up on robots, but with enough practice, people should be able to keep a hula hoop spinning regardless of body shape. People can learn to adapt their gyrations based on the position of the hoop. Even the robots could learn this trick. The researchers got the cone-shaped robot to successfully hula hoop by adjusting its rate of wiggling depending on how high the hoop slid. The new findings offer hints for people learning to hula hoop. First is how to launch their hoop. In the tests, a slow launch prevented robots from keeping the hoop up, so make sure to spin it fast. Positioning the hoop correctly also helps. In successful experiments, the hoop lined up with the robot's body so that the hoop and the body always shifted in the same direction. Hula hoopers should try to launch that way, too. If you start with your hips out to the right, start with the hoop out to your right, and then swing the hoop around quickly and start swiveling your hips in that same direction. A final tip gleaned from the research: bigger hoops are good for beginners. They can be supported with slower gyrations. Okay, next article. Right here on Bigler's World. Let's switch magazines here. National Geographic Kids magazine, just for the kids. They got an article on poison dart frogs. These frogs are considered one of the Earth's most toxic or poisonous species. At the same time, the common name is poison dart frogs. The scientific name is Dendrobatidae. Say that three times fast. It's an amphibian. It is a carnivore. Its group name is an army, which makes sense. Average lifespan in the wild, 3 to 15 years, and it's only an inch long. With a range of bright colors, yellows, oranges, reds, greens, blues, poison dart frogs aren't just big show-offs either. No, no. These colorful designs tell potential predators, "I'm toxic. Don't eat me." For example, the golden poison dart frog has enough poison to kill 20,000 mice. Scientists think that poison dart frogs get their toxicity from some of the insects they eat. How do poison dart frogs capture their prey? Then it says slurp. With a long, sticky tongue that darts out and zaps the unsuspecting bug. The frogs eat many kinds of small insects, including fruit flies, ants, termites, young crickets, and tiny beetles, which are the ones that scientists think may be responsible for the frogs' toxicity. Poison dart frogs live in the rainforests of Central and South America. That's it. That's all they got. Next article. Sticking with National Geographic Kids, Harriet Tubman, spy. You might know her as conductor for the Underground Railroad. She was also a spy. Harriet Tubman cautiously watched over the shore from one of three gunboats on the Combahee River. She and several hundred Union soldiers were preparing to raid to free hundreds of enslaved people from plantations in South Carolina, part of the Confederate states that were fighting against the Union during the Civil War of 1861 to 1865. Enemy soldiers were hiding nearby, and success was far from guaranteed. Harriet Tubman is well known for risking her life as a conductor in the Underground Railroad. which led escaped enslaved people to freedom in the North. But the former enslaved woman also served as a spy for the Union during the Civil War. Tubman decided to help the Union Army because she wanted freedom for all of the people who were forced into slavery, not just the few that she could help on the Underground Railroad. She convinced many other brave African Americans to join her as spies, even at the risk of being hanged if they were caught. A secret mission. The Civil War was a time when women were usually restricted to traditional roles like cooking and nursing. Tubman did jobs like that, but as a spy, she worked side by side with men, says Tom Allen, author of the Nat Geo book, Harriet Tubman, Secret Agent. In one of her most dramatic and dangerous roles, Tubman helped Colonel James Montgomery plan a raid to free enslaved people from plantations along the, let's see, how do you pronounce this, Cumbie River in South Carolina. Early on in the morning of June 1st, 1863, three gunboats carrying several hundred male soldiers along with Tubman set out on their mission. Tubman had gathered key information from her scouts about the Confederate positions. She knew where they were hiding along the shore. She also found out that they had placed torpedoes or barrels filled with gunpowder in the water. As the early morning fog lifted from some of the South's most important rice plantations, the Union expedition hit hard. The raiders set fire to buildings and destroyed bridges so they couldn't be used by the Confederate Army. They also freed about 750 enslaved people, men, women, children, and babies, and did not lose one soldier in the attack. A writer's quest. To gather the facts, Allen searched libraries and the Internet and even walked in Tubman's footsteps, he says. I went on the river just south of the area where the raid took place, he says. You're in that kind of country, she would have known, with plenty of mosquitoes and snakes and dirt roads are still there today, so you get a feeling of what it was like. Allen says his most exciting moment came when a librarian led him to the written accounts by people who actually saw Tubman and the other raiders in action. She was 5'2" tall, born a slave, had a debilitating illness, and was unable to read or write. Yet here was this tough woman who could take charge and lead men, Allen says. I got to like her pretty quickly because of her strength and her spirit. Okay, let's go to another publication. Let's do Student News Daily. This article entitled, U.S. Unveils Sixth Generation F-47 Fighter Jet. Ba-dum-bum-bum-ba-dum. Doesn't say who wrote this, but it was compiled from military.com and NY Post. I guess that's New York. President Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth announced Friday that the U.S. will begin producing the world's first sixth-generation fighter jet. The new F-47 will be used alongside the fifth-generation F-35, which has been long heralded for its superior stealth capabilities. In its Navy variant, the F-35, that was the first U.S. fighter jet to be able to land vertically like a helicopter, allowing it to touch down on ships with limited runway room. Trump joked that he liked the name of the new jet, which shares the same number as Trump's second administration. He denied naming it after himself, insisting that the generals pick a title and it's a beautiful number. Beautiful. Details about the new asset were limited to protect against foreign adversaries, gleaning intelligence about it. Trump mentioned the F-47 would be the first aircraft to be able to fly with drones, though it was unclear what he meant. Okay, so what do we got here? The article continues down here. While production formally began with Trump's Friday announcement, the F-47 project has been underway for years, with prototypes in the air since 2020, the president said from the Oval Office. Known as Next Generation Air Dominance, or NGAD, the manned jet will serve as quarterback to a fleet of future drone aircraft designed to be able to penetrate the air defenses of China and any other potential foes. The initial contract to proceed with production on a version for the Air Force is worth an estimated $20 billion. The F-47 is expected to replace the F-22 Raptor, which embarked on its first flight back in 1997 under Lockheed Martin. The new jet, for which Trump did not give a cost estimate, citing operational security concerns, is expected to fly alongside loyal wingman drones or uncrewed aircraft. See, in an email statement following the Oval Office announcement, Alvin, who is he? They didn't say who he is here. Somebody named Alvin said that the Air Force has been flying experimental planes, or X-planes, for the last 5 years, laying the foundation for the F-47 in an effort to cement U.S. air dominance. He adds that the F-47 is expected to fly during the Trump administration and that it would cost less than the F-22. Last year, the Biden administration's Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall ordered a pause on the NGAD program to review if the aircraft was still needed or if the program, which was first designed in 2018 during Trump's first administration, needed to be modified to reflect the past few years of warfighting advances. That review by think tanks and academia, not the military, examined what conflict with China would look like with NGAD and then without it, and determined that NGAD was still needed. A separate Navy contract for its version of NGAD fighter is still under competition between Northrop Grumman and Boeing. In addition, the Pentagon's future stealth bomber, the B-21 Raider, will have many of the same cutting-edge technologies in advanced metals, AI, propulsion, and stealth. A fleet of about 100 B-21 stealth bombers at an estimated total cost of at least $130 billion is also planned. The first B-21 aircraft are now in test flights. Okay, let's shift gears here a little bit and go over to Highlights, Highlights Magazine. Matt Siegel wrote this. Ever wonder where different snacks come from? Some were created by accident. Others started out as health foods or even medicines. Really? Over time, people experimented with flavors and ingredients to make the treats we know today. First off, they get cheese puffs. How did that happen? Cheese puffs, a powdery history. Cheese puffs were invented by accident in the 1930s when Edward Wilson used cornmeal to clean up equipment he'd used for making animal feed. He noticed that the machine's heat caused the corn to puff up. But the cheesy powder used to flavor them has its own story. It was developed as a snack for the United States military. Regular cheese went bad quickly and was heavy to carry, so scientists created a dehydrated cheese powder that was lighter and stayed fresh longer. And then on the chocolate here, a bittersweet history of chocolate. People have been consuming chocolate for thousands of years. Ancient Maya and Aztecs of Central America would roast the seeds of cacao beans, grind them into paste, and add boiling water to make a chocolatey drink. But it was bitter. European explorers got their first taste of chocolate in the 1500s. They added ingredients like sugar and vanilla, turning it into a dessert. Then there's cereal, a boring history. It says, modern cereal makers try hard to make cereals appealing, but the first cold breakfast cereals created in the 1890s were designed to be as boring as possible. Cereal pioneers John Harvey Kellogg and C.W. Post believed sugar and spices caused people to behave wildly, so they set out to create the least exciting food they could think of. Their first cereals were practically tasteless, and they were so hard that they had to be soaked in milk so that they wouldn't break people's teeth. The first sweet cereals were created by John Harvey Kellogg's brother, Will Keith, or W.K. Kellogg. He began adding sugar and including free toys inside cereal boxes. Then there's French fries, a fishy history. The origin of French fries is a bit of a mystery. They most likely originated in Belgium, not France, in the 1600s as a substitute for fried fish during the winter when frozen waters made fishing more difficult. So why do we call them French fries? Well, the name probably refers to the method of slicing foods into thin strips called Frenching. At first, French fries struggled to become popular in America because deep frying caused lots of burns and kitchen accidents. But by the 1950s, the invention of safer fryers and fast food drive-thrus helped fries become a favorite on-the-go snack. Then there's a fiery history. Evidence found in ancient caves in the Americas suggests that people were popping corn as early as 5,000 years ago. They would cook kernels in hot sand or throw them into open fires and catch them as they popped. I gotta try that. Making popcorn became easier in the mid-1800s with the invention of an over-the-fire popper. And it became really easy in the mid-1980s after microwaves became common. In fact, Percy Spencer, the inventor of the microwave oven, used popcorn in his experiments while discovering microwave technology. And what is this? Veggie vision. Nutrients in carrots are good for your eyes, but it's a myth that they give you better night vision. During World War II, the British Royal Air Force had radar technology to spot planes at night, but they wanted to keep it secret, so they said that eating carrots helped their pilots see in the dark. And then there's a thing on carrots here, a colorful history. Thousands of years ago, wild carrots were not orange. Purple was the most common color, but they also grew in shades of white, yellow, red, and black. Early carrots were also shaped differently than modern carrots, with thin branched roots similar to tree roots. The orange carrots we know today didn't appear until the 1600s, when farmers crossbred different varieties to make carrots thicker, softer, and sweeter. And did you know that baby carrots aren't really baby carrots? They're regular carrots cut into small, uniform shapes. They became popular in the 1980s after farmers began cutting up carrots that were too bent or broken to sell whole. I will be doggone. Then there's root beer. A medicinal history of this. Root beer wasn't always the sweet, fizzy treat we know today. Its roots go back to the 1700s when it was used as a health tonic made from ingredients like sarsaparilla root, wintergreen leaves, birch bark, licorice, and cinnamon. People believed it was a natural cure-all for everything from colds to headaches, and they prepared it as a hot tea or syrup. It wasn't until the 1850s that drugstore pharmacists decided to mix it with bubbly soda water, creating a refreshing drink that quickly became a hit. And there's a not-so-sweet history. The earliest pies were small hand pies about the size of modern Pop-Tarts, but with more filling and no frosting. They were usually savory rather than sweet, filled with meat and vegetables rather than fruit. These pies were a popular snack because they could be eaten on the go without plates or utensils. Their thick, hard crusts were often meant just to hold the ingredients together, and people sometimes threw the crusts away. They threw stuff away back then, too. Some historians think that pie crust changed when American colonists ran low on wheat and were forced to stretch their dough to make it last, resulting in the thinner, flakier crusts we know today. Pies from the past. A few hundred years ago, pie fillings tasted very different than they do today. Would you eat any of these? They have pigeon pie, pigeons, butter, and sweet herbs. There's oyster pie, oysters, lemon, parsley, and nutmeg. Then there's eel pie, eels, salt, and pepper. That's all that's in there. Stargazy pie, what is that? Fish heads poking out of the crust so they appear to be gazing at the stars. How do you dip? It says, would you want to try these popular French fries dips from across the globe? Okay, in Belgium, they have mayonnaise. The Philippines have banana ketchup. The United Kingdom is vinegar. That makes sense. In Canada, they like their gravy. In Vietnam, it's butter and sugar. In Japan, it's seaweed powder. And in Iceland, it's cocktail sauce. Who knew that some of your favorite snacks had such interesting origin stories? The next time you munch on something tasty, just think you're taking a bite out of history. Oh, yes. Okay, next article here. Sticking with highlights. Car Crushers is the name of this, by Kim T. Griswell. Worn-out cars can become planet-saving resources. When the junkyard down the street from his auto repair shop calls, master mechanic Rob Lowry cheers. The cars cluttering his back lot are about to get a new life. A tow truck hauls the cars to the junkyard. There, fluids that can pollute the environment are drained. Gas, oil, coolant, and other fluids are filtered and resold. An experienced mechanic checks the cars for parts to reuse, repair, or recycle. That includes batteries, bumpers, seats, stereos, wheels, windows, engines, and more. Next, a mobile car crusher rumbles into the junkyard. A forklift lifts a car onto the crusher. Huge metal plates come down and squish. The car is flattened. Crushed cars then go to a scrapyard. A giant claw picks up each car and drops it into a conveyor belt. The belt moves the car through a rolling, ripping shredder. It takes only 2 or 5 seconds to shred, 2 to 5 seconds to shred a car. Dump trucks deliver the shredded steel to a steel mill. The metal is melted into a giant pot, poured out, and then pressed into sheets and bars to be reused. Recycling cars can save 23 million barrels of oil each year. It can build 13 million new cars and reduce greenhouse gases by 12 million tons. Says Lowry, it's a big win for the planet. More than 80% of a car's parts can be reused or recycled. Retired. Let's see, in the United States, nearly 300 million tires are disposed of every year, but they don't all end up in landfills. No, no, most are recycled. Recycled tires can become, they got a long list here, roads, sneakers, running tracks, outdoor furniture, playground surfaces, floor tiles, and brand new tires, for that matter. Okay, let's do some jokes and riddles from highlights. Let's see here. How do you get skin? How do you get dry skin from towels? How do you get dry skin from? What do you get dry skin from? Towels. Okay, that makes sense. Why did the novel check its reservation to make sure it had booked its flight? That makes sense. Not really funny, but it makes sense. What is a computer's favorite snack? A computer chip. That's just, these are really getting worse. What restaurant do people go to when it's windy? Wendy's. what did the frog wear to the dance? A jumpsuit. That's just common sense. What is a hyena's favorite kind of cookie? A snickerdoodle. What did the banana say to the orange? Nothing. Bananas don't talk. And one more here. Why did the teacher write on the window? He wanted his lesson to be clear. Okay, next article here on Bigler's World. Means we're going to have to go over to Time for Kids. That's right, it's Time Magazine for Kids. Getting the Shot is the name of this article by Time for Kid kid reporter Meyer Ballas. Let's see, who did I pronounce this name? Carrie Giordano. Works fast. She's a photographer for two professional sports teams in California, baseball's Los Angeles Dodgers and football's Los Angeles Rams. This means she's constantly racing to follow the action. TFK Kid reporter Meyer Ballas, who lives in Los Angeles, interviewed Giordano about her job, and it commands me to read their conversation and check out some of Giordano's photographs below. Okay, so they got a picture of Matthew Stafford firing off a pass. He looks very awkward, and a guy's about to knock him down. Okay, they asked her, how did you get into sports photography, Gary? She says, well, I was one of those kids who always had a camera, but I didn't think it would be a career path for me. When I started shooting Little League, it was just a side job. Later, I got a job at Dodger Stadium. I went back to school for photography, thinking I would do landscape photography. But one time at Dodger Stadium, I met John Suhu, who let me hold his camera, and from that point on, I was hooked. How did you get your current job with the Dodgers? Well, I started off doing all these little shoots no one wanted to do, like photographing someone signing autographs really far away. I started working for Sports Media Company, which is basically a company that shoots the games and supplies them to the news. The pay was terrible, but I did that for a couple of years until one of the Dodger photographers was leaving, so that's how I got in. What's your favorite moment to have documented? Well, there have been a lot of good ones, but any baseball walk-offs are really exciting since I get to run onto the field. If I had to pick one, it would be when the Dodgers clinched their division in 2019. It was so exciting, they had a huge celebration. What advice would you give someone who's interested in photography? Well, hard work and work up. go out and shoot some sporting events. For example, I don't shoot a lot of soccer, but my son just started playing, so I've been shooting at his games. It doesn't take a big arena or pro sports to get good at it. Once you get a good portfolio, whether it's Little League, high school, or college, then you can kind of show people that, and they might trust you for a job. So really, just document as much as you can. Okay, let's us switch over to Frontiers for Young Minds. This article entitled, What Are Model Organisms, and Why Do We Use Them in Biology Research? Arpita Yadav can tell us, I guess. Model organisms in research. Why do researchers prefer to use some animals and plants over humans in their scientific studies? Research on human subjects is difficult and unethical, as participants may not fully understand the research and its associated risks. The research may involve procedures that may cause physical or emotional harm to the participants. In addition, there may be a breach of confidentiality and invasion of privacy of the participants. This gets complicated here. To avoid these difficulties and ethical concerns, researchers use model organisms in biology research. Certain species called model organisms are used because they are simple to grow and study and because they have important similarities with humans or other organisms of interest. Similarities allow researchers to make use of life mechanisms that are shared across these species. The study of model organisms has been critical in expanding our knowledge of biology. Model organisms help us to understand complex life systems in detail. Much of our knowledge about genes, evolution, ecology, and behavior has come from studying model organisms. Let's see, the article continues down here. Pea plants, to study plant genetics. The field of genetics investigates the passing down or inheritance of traits from one generation to the next. There has been much progress and discovery in this exciting field throughout the years. Gregor Johann Mendel is an important character in the genetics history. Way back in 1886, he wrote an important paper about how genes are passed down from parents to their offspring, and this work paved the way for modern research in genetics. There was not much known about the field of genetics during Mendel's time, but it was not until the early 20th century that researchers started to make good progress. Maize as a model to study plant heterosis. I love heterosis. I don't know what it means, but I love it. Z. maize, commonly known as corn or maize, is one of the most studied plant species. Corn is a major staple crop worldwide. It is pollinated by the wind, and it has distinct male and female flowers, making it easy for scientists to work with and study. It is a great model for understanding why an offspring of two different species might have superior traits compared to either parent. This phenomenon is called heterosis. Corn plants also produce a lot of pollen, making it easier for scientists and researchers to create mutant plants by treating corn pollen with chemicals to examine how mutations affect plant properties. Way back in 1983, maize researcher Barbara McClintock won the Nobel Prize for discovering jumping genes, also called transposons, in maize. Transposons are DNA segments that can move from one place to another within a genome. She used maize plants to study how transposons influence the activity of genes and genome evolution. Then there's the mouse ear cress as a model to study plant genetics. In 1943, Friedrich Liebach, he presented Arabidopsis, also called mouse ear cress, a model organism for studying plant genetics. Arabidopsis thaliana is a small weedy plant growing across Europe, North America, and Asia, and is great for studying plant genetics. And there's fruit flies as a model to study human genetics. The pea plant taught scientists basic genetics, but to study humans, researchers preferred species that were more similar to us than plants. So the fruit fly called Drosophila melanogaster became a valuable model organism. It is simple and inexpensive to grow, and these insects in a lab, they are found all over the world. are all over my house. The fruit fly has a short life cycle of about 8 to 10 days, making it ideal for genetic research. The study of fruit flies led to the discovery that genes are physical features of chromosomes. That is crazy stuff. And there's the zebrafish as a model to study human development. The zebrafish, Danio rerio, is a popular model organism for studies of genetics and development. There are many similarities between these freshwater fish and fruit flies. They only have a three-month life cycle. They are cheap and simple to grow in the lab, and they reproduce rapidly. However, unlike fruit flies, zebrafish are vertebrates and hence have more in common with humans, including muscles, hearts, kidneys, and eyeballs. I hope so. Emerging model organisms and artificial intelligence. The field of genetics and biology have greatly benefited from the model species we have described, and the number of new model organisms is growing. Each model organism helps researchers gain vital insights into the systems that control life and how organisms form and function. Recently, technological advances have enabled scientists to explore a wider range of non-traditional organisms that were previously less studied. These include, Volvox, a green algae used to study the evolution of multicellular life. There's Nemotostella, which is really good with hot sauce, a sea anemone used to understand body plan development. Then there's tardigrade, should have known that, also known as a water bear, used to study survival in extreme conditions. There's Oxytrichia, a psyllid used to study genome complexity and DNA modifications. To be widely used as a model organism, an organism's chemical building blocks, or the sequence of the nucleotides that make up an organism's DNA, should be known. That would help. Knowing this DNA sequence allows scientists to make changes to the genes to study biological processes. Scientists also consider other factors to decide which model organism to use for a particular study, mainly involving whether the organism's features and processes will allow them to answer their specific scientific questions. In summary, model organisms share genetic similarities with humans, making them useful for studying human diseases. They are easy to grow in a lab and are more accessible to genetic manipulations for studying gene function. They are also less expensive and yield faster results, accelerating the discovery process in biology research. And with that, I'm out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.